Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing Steve Bannon, the White House budget and tax cuts for the wealthy, and homelessness in San Francisco. Today's guest, Ben Weider, reports that shortly after Donald Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, left the White House, a company with close ties to him was hired by the United Arab Emirates to launch a social media campaign against its Arab neighbor, Qatar. It was a part of a multi-million-dollar effort by several Middle Eastern nations to isolate Qatar that received a boost when Trump criticized the country. The UAE is paying $330,000 to a firm with the same parent company as Cambridge Analytica. That's the business Trump employed to reach voters with hyper-targeted online messaging during the campaign. Ben Weider is a data reporter with the McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington. He's a former reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where he covered money and politics, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Joe Eskenazi wrote the cover story for the latest edition of SF Public Press. It's called No Vacancy for the Homeless. He reports that dozens of residential hotels, also called SROs, have rooms to spare, but the city of San Francisco cannot force owners to rent them. Joe Eskenazi is a San Francisco-based journalist. He's editor-at-large at San Francisco Magazine, and he writes a weekly column at Mission Local. And Joe joins us in studio. Hi, Joe. Thank you for coming in. Well,
thanks for asking me to be here.
Great to have you and great reporting.
Thank you.
Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight reporting that stood out this week. So, Joe Eskenazi, let's start off with you. What stood out for you this week?
Well, I chose in the We Laugh So As Not to Cry category. My friend and colleague Lauren Smiley had a piece in New York Magazine about what it takes to get into the most elite bomb shelters in the country, with excerpts from aspirants' essays making their case as to why they should be allowed into the cream of the crop of bomb shelters.
Elite bomb shelters?
You know, I mean, if you've ever seen Dr. Strangelove, you know, they weren't just let just anybody into these bomb shelters, and people had to have the right skills and put it in an articulate way in an entry essay.
Who has these elite bomb shelters?
If memory serves, they were fairly remote, the ones that that she talked about in the story. But these were, including one, I believe, in the Midwest that could sustain life for a bus full of people for a year. These are people who are wealthy disaster preparedness types.
Hmm. Well, all right. Thank you for that.
It's amazing this is relevant.
It is amazing that it's relevant, but here we are today, and that is a piece by Lauren Smiley in New York Magazine. All right. Thank you for that. What about you, Ben Weider? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I'll have to read that New York Magazine piece.
Yeah.
But, a couple things I wanted to briefly mention, which was one was a piece in Mother Jones earlier in the week looking at Jeff Sessions and his ties to both a coal company and a law firm that are involved in a bribery scandal. They are accused of bribing a state representative who ultimately threw his support in their favor. They were fighting against a particular environmental designation from the EPA that would have potentially made the coal company liable for millions of dollars in damages that they would have had to pay or costs associated with this designation. And Jeff Sessions ultimately is going to preside over this case, but both the coal company and the law firm are huge donors to Sessions over the course of his career, and to date, he has not recused himself from this. So, pretty classic example of conflict of interest at really the highest levels, and really a sad story because at its core, the bribery scandal, what this all involved was a neighborhood in Birmingham where the environmental conditions were so bad that residents nearby were essentially told that their kids shouldn't play in the yard and they shouldn't leave their houses because it was so polluted. So it was a really amazing deep dive into this, going, you know, going to the roots of the scandal and Sessions' involvement in it. And then briefly wanted to mention Marshall Project has a new video series, sort of faces of the criminal justice system, people who have kind of been in it from all sides, both people who've been in prison, prison guards, people affected by people whose family members were incarcerated, and it's very powerfully done. It's these short videos with just kind of a person's face close up, telling, you know, in many cases these really horrific stories. So very powerful. I think it's We Are Witness, I think, is the project. So
checking out. Yeah, thank you for that. The Marshall Project does really great work. Just quickly going back to the Mother Jones piece you mentioned, which is by Russ Choma and Nick Schwellenbach. Jeff Sessions is in charge of a bribery prosecution involving two of his top donors. You know, what's amazing about this, Ben and Joe, if you'd like to dive in, there's so much great reporting going on about corruption within the Trump administration. And yet, when you listen to broadcast media and the headlines that constantly get repeated, it's about the tweets and just the scandal of the day. I mean, why isn't something like this getting at least a tenth of the attention of the latest tweet? Ben, you're in D.C. What do you think about that?
It's very hard, unfortunately. I mean, there's questions as to whether, you know, some of these tweets are a deliberate, distraction attempt. Look at this, don't look over there, kind of thing. But in general, I mean, I think, you know, there's a sort of desire or instinct to kind of go towards the most salacious. And, you know, the Sessions case, to really understand what's going on here, you have to kind of go beyond just the headline. I mean, the headline is good and interesting and I think pretty captivating, but it's a very nuanced story. Whereas, so much of what you see on these tweets are these very simple kind of battles between one side, whether it's, you know, Trump administration and mainstream Republicans, whether it's Trump administration and the press, Trump administration and Democrats. They're very sort of simple kind of one side versus the other side, kind of black and white narratives, and they just take up so much attention. You'd think there'd be almost some sort of fatigue surrounding it, but it does seem like there's kind of an insatiable appetite for it.
I will give kudos to Massimo Calabresi with Time Magazine. The cover of this week's Time Magazine is The Wrecking Crew, How Trump's Cabinet is Dismantling Government as We Know It. And the headline of the piece is, While Trump is Tweeting, These Three People Are Undoing Government as We Know It. It focuses on Scott Pruitt, Betsy DeVos, and Ben Carson. What are your thoughts on this, Joe, as someone who's out here on the West Coast? There's great reporting going on, but what gets the attention in the broadcast media and what gets repeated over and over again?
I think people have become inured to politicians behaving badly, and I think that is something that filters down at all levels. This is probably of no interest to Ben, but here in San Francisco, the current mayor explicitly promised he wouldn't run for mayor, and then there was a very overt campaign that quote-unquote convinced him to run for mayor. And, you know, as a reporter at the time, I thought, well, this is going to be a problem. You know, he is only mayor because he promised to not run. That is the reason he's there. The one thing he said he would not do is run for mayor, and now he's running for mayor. But people didn't care because the explanation I heard over and over again is, politicians are less than truthful. Mm. As if you have no say in this. As if you cannot do something about that. If this was a problem to you, then you don't vote for that person. But that doesn't seem to have occurred to people. Not to say, you know, again, separate and apart from anything else that's happened, you know, with your position on the mayor and whether he's doing a good job or a bad job, you don't have to accept when politicians behave badly. It is not something that you just shrug your shoulders about.
Hmm. Well, thank you for these great pieces. We will put links to all of them at yourcallradio.org right after the show. Joe Eskenazi is a reporter here in San Francisco, editor-at-large at San Francisco Magazine. He wrote the cover story for the latest edition of SF Public Press called No Vacancy for the Homeless. Ben Weider is a data reporter with McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington. Let's dive in and talk about your piece, Ben, Steve Bannon's Already Murky Middle East Ties Deepen. And you report that the United Arab Emirates is paying $330,000 to a firm with the same parent company as Cambridge Analytica. Remind us, tell us about the ties between Cambridge Analytica, Donald Trump, and Steve Bannon.
Yeah, well, Cambridge Analytica is a company that originated, you know, in the UK, but they've imported a lot of people and technology to the US. And essentially, what they claim to do is be able to provide very targeted influence through online means, through social media, through various other things. You know, the idea is that this, in theory, that they're more persuasive than kind of a traditional political ad, and that they can target very specifically, you know, the people that campaigns are trying to reach the most. Maybe, you know, it's the people who are on the fence, and they're able to really focus on getting those people, or to make sure that, you know, the base shows up on behalf of the candidate they're working for. They worked on behalf of Presidential Trump's campaign in 2016. They were paid somewhere north of about $5 million for their work. The company has gotten at least some of its funding from the Mercer family. Robert Mercer is the sort of patriarch of the family. His daughter Rebecca, also a big political donor, and they've emerged in recent years as among the biggest political donors in the Republican Party. And Cambridge Analytica is an operation they've heavily invested in, and I know that they believe in and have encouraged candidates that they support to use. You know, one example is Ted Cruz. Before the Mercers threw their support to Trump, they first supported Cruz, and Cruz used Cambridge Analytica. Where Bannon fits in that is that Bannon has many ties to the Mercers. They're big funders of Breitbart News, which he ran before joining the Trump campaign and is now back at since leaving the White House. Bannon himself listed an ownership stake worth between $1 and $5 million in Cambridge Analytica when he entered the White House. And he, before joining the Trump campaign, he had held a couple positions on Cambridge Analytica's board. So this is a company that he has, you know, his own money tied up in, that he had a position on the board in, closely connected to. Now, the company that got this contract from the UAE is a company called SCL Social Limited. And SCL Social Limited is under the parent company SCL Group. That's also Cambridge Analytica's parent company. And SCL Social Limited is, in fact, according to their paperwork, run by the same person, a guy named Alexander Nix, who runs Cambridge Analytica. Alexander Nix, by the way, in the news this week because there was reporting showing that he had reached out to Julian Assange to try to help out with spreading information about the hacked DNC and Podesta emails. So clearly, Alexander Nix, Cambridge Analytica, had ties to the Trump campaign, clearly have ties to Bannon, and, you know, so this was a very interesting connection. And, you know, Bannon has had some other ties to the UAE. He, since leaving office in September, he took a trip to the UAE, and, you know, we don't know exactly what he talked about. We don't know who was paying for it. And, you know, there are a couple of different explanations, perhaps, as to why he might have been there. But, you know, there's just all these things that keep popping up. And you know, we wrote our story before an event Monday where Steve Bannon actually took the stage and, you know, offered sort of a full-throated support for the blockade of Qatar, which basically a few countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt, have essentially, you know, tried to cut off all ties with Qatar, citing a variety of things: Qatar's support for terrorism, Qatar's relationship with Iran, and, you know, it's believed that, you know, among other reasons that they're upset at Qatar is also its sponsorship of Al Jazeera, which, you know, that's been a subject of some of the information that they've put out in attacking Qatar. So, you know, these ties are just kind of all popping up, and it wasn't 100% clear where Bannon himself personally stood in the conflict. He hadn't said much publicly about it, but at this event on Monday, which is after our story ran, he was unhesitatingly in support of the blockade and said, you know, the demands that these countries had issued to Qatar, in, you know, that they were hoping that it would meet in exchange for them, you know, resuming normal relations. He called them reasonable. He, you know, basically said, you know, I'm 100% behind it. And he actually even said that he thinks this conflict in the Middle East is the most important thing happening in the world. You know, specifically saying North Korea, other things happening, you know, they are all secondary compared to this conflict in the Middle East.
And just quickly, Ben, can you summarize this? I mean, people listening thinking, what is Steve Bannon doing? What are his ties to the Middle East? I mean, when you've done all this reporting, what are your conclusions?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, we know that there's this company that has a contract that's connected to him. We know that he's talked about wanting to start a Breitbart international conference series. So it's possible that he's talking to some of these countries in the hopes that they'll support that conference series. One of the most common paths for senior officials after they leave office in Washington is to do work officially or unofficially on behalf of foreign governments. Bannon was speaking at, Leon Panetta and General David Petraeus were also speaking at. So it's very common for top-ranking officials to kind of go out and become involved in these discussions and make money doing it after they leave office. So, you know, there's certainly a potential financial stake as well. Where it fits into his broader ideology and worldview is a little harder to say. I mean, you know, to hear him tell it on Monday, he sees the blockade as a crucial step in the fight against, you know, what he calls radical Islamic terrorism. He sees it as, you know, this is perhaps a domino, that the first domino to fall that, you know, ultimately leads to the end of this. That's certainly what he says when he talks on stage. I think that observers of the Middle East say it's maybe a little bit more nuanced than that. And, you know, some of the countries on the other side of the blockade, opposed from Qatar, have their own issues as well, which he doesn't really focus on in what he's saying. He just focuses on one side of it. But yeah, I mean, it's murky because there's certainly the financial concern, which is real. The financial aspect of it is real, which is, you know, Breitbart's trying to raise money. SCL, this company he's connected to, is making money. And then there's also the worldview and the ideology and, you know, his kind of broader political philosophy. What's tricky is that it's hard to know, you know, is a certain statement being made in furtherance of the ideology, or is a certain statement being made in furtherance of the commercial interests?
I wanted to ask you, Joe, I know this is not your beat, but a lot of people were surprised when they learned that Steve Bannon was the keynote at last Friday's California Republican Party convention. And, you know, some of the headlines said Steve Bannon brings war to California. He was just basically talking about how to win. And he was embraced. He got a lot of applause. He did get some criticism from House members of the GOP saying that it just sends the wrong message. What are your thoughts on that?
It got them attention that they wouldn't otherwise have because the California GOP is irrelevant. I see it that way. The only reason for a Republican of national prominence to come to California is to raise money, and lots of it. There's lots of money in California. Mm. They'll never win California. The demographics are against them. The ideology is against them. The policies they're pushing specifically are meant to punish this state, and I think that voters are not dumb enough to ignore that, but they can still raise a lot of money and get a lot of attention. Steve Bannon is the living embodiment of an internet comment section bred with talk radio, and he gets attention. That's what he's designed to do, as well as make money in shady, nefarious ways, as Ben so aptly reported and pointed out for us this morning. So that's what that was about. The attention was gotten.
Mm. Before we let you go, Ben, what were your thoughts on that?
I think that Steve Bannon, it's an interesting kind of moment for Steve Bannon in the sense of, you know, 2018 is going to really be a test of kind of the lasting power of the Steve Bannon brand of politics. He, with the financial backing of the Mercer family, has come out and basically said he's going to target, you know, any kind of mainstream Republican who doesn't fall in line with the policies that he supports. And it's going to be a very interesting referendum. I mean, certainly 2018 is a referendum on Trump, but, you know, one might argue it's an even greater referendum on Steve Bannon. And he's had this kind of war of words with Karl Rove, the kind of Steve Bannon 1.0, or earlier version of Steve Bannon in the Bush era, and there's this sort of real fight as to which of their visions of the Republican Party is going to win out. And I think to some extent that's really going to be one of the underlying questions of 2018, is how successful is Steve Bannon in getting his vision to spread across the country. I mean, we saw in Alabama with Roy Moore winning the special election that, that was a win for the Bannon camp of the Republican Party. It will be interesting to see how far it spreads in 2018. And I think that, that is what this is all about. And to the point about, raising money in California, certainly, even though California is not likely to, on a large scale, go Republican anytime soon, there are clearly some sympathetic folks in California with large wallets who like to spend on politics for the Republican Party. And so, in that sense, yes, it makes perfect sense for Bannon to be out there. And let's not forget, Bannon is himself someone who has spent plenty of time in California and made a fortune essentially during his time out in LA. So he is no stranger to California and to the coasts. Even if he might present himself as the embodiment of kind of the middle America common person.
Well, Ben, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ben Weider is a data reporter with the McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington. Check out his latest piece, Steve Bannon's Already Murky Middle East Ties Deepen. There's also a good piece in Esquire by Charles Pierce. It's One Big Happy Family and They're All in It for the Money. Steve Bannon, Eric Prince, the lot of them. Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, is thinking about running for Senate in Wyoming. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. Joining us for the rest of the hour is Joe Eskenazi. He wrote the cover story for the latest edition of SF Public Press called No Vacancy for the Homeless. He reports that dozens of residential hotels have rooms to spare, but the city of San Francisco cannot force owners to rent them. Joe, there's been a lot of great reporting about just SROs and the fact that they have not been upgraded, and a lot of people who live in SROs are living in horrific conditions. Why did you decide to focus on the angle looking at the fact that a lot of these SRO rooms are open, but the city can't force the owners to rent them?
This was a piece where I worked with the public press, and my editors were Michael Winter and Noah Arroyo, and my initial pitch was to write more about master leasing, and they were interested in this, and this is where the reporting took me. It struck me as being, we have better data than I thought we could get, and people can spin the numbers any which way they want, but when it comes down to it, 2,000 rooms is 2,000 rooms. And so I thought, it's just, you start with the premise of, right in the lead, every night there are thousands of homeless people and every night there are thousands of rooms that are lying empty, and then we get more complicated. There are limits to what government can do. Government in private property, they can only tell you so much about how much, what you can do with it. And, if you wish to leave the room empty, that is something that you are entitled to do. And so we do bump into limits upon government power.
For those who are not familiar with SROs, that term is just thrown around, SRO. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what they are?
Sure. It does not stand for standing room only. It's a single room occupancy. And this is often you'll see them in the Tenderloin, but they're all around the city, the Mission. There's a map that the graphics in this edition of the Public Press are really spectacular. They have really good people there, and soon you'll be able to see it on the internet as well at sfpublicpress.org. These are the hotels where there is a shared bathroom, and there are shared bathroom facilities, and you have small rooms, sometimes as small as 10 by 10 and older, even smaller than that, where people paid traditionally very low rates. Of late, you have a broader group of people who are trying to get into SROs, and some of them are willing to pay what you and I would probably consider very exorbitant rents for what you're getting.
I was shocked to learn that they're paying thousands of dollars for these rooms.
Yes, yes. I mean, in the same way, if a lot of people would do that, you know, they're. I was talking with one of your producers that, you know, traditionally SROs were not for the most indigent, as we now envision them to be, for people who are one step above homelessness. Traditionally, you know, in the days when San Francisco was an industrial blue-collar city, you would have stevedores, you know, dock workers living there. And still you do have bartenders and musicians and itinerant workers and things like that. You know, he's passed, but the fellow who was the Macy's Santa Claus for many years lived at the Budget Inn across from Civic Center Plaza, you know, which was an SRO and has since been, I believe it's now owned by the city and has a different name, run by the city. Whatever's the case, the fellow lived in an SRO and because he had his itinerant Santa Claus work. Yeah. So that's an example of that kind of thing. As the city changed and as the needs changed, these SROs were kind of forced into being a stopgap for homeless people. And the city runs through its master leasing program in which it essentially buys the buildings and contracts with a nonprofit to run them. You have, or rather rents out the whole buildings. You have upwards of 4,000 people who would otherwise probably be homeless or worse living in San Francisco, you know. That's not what these rooms were originally intended for. It's what we're using them for. But now, you know, you will have more people, even people of means, wanting to get in there because they, you know, we could come up with hypotheticals. They might have food at work, you know, if you're a tech person. You might have food and even bathroom facilities at work, a gym. You might not be home very much. So, you know, paying $1,500 or more for an SRO is not crazy if it's just basically, you know, a place to crash when you're not working.
As you report, according to the latest count, the official numbers, there are 4,353 unsheltered people in San Francisco. 1,020 are between 18 and 24 years old.
Yeah, so if you look at the number of empty rooms and look at the number of people who would need rooms, there is a synchronicity there. Now, take a step back. The point-in-time homeless count is notoriously unscientific, but it is the best bad data we've got. The numbers with the SRO rooms are better. These are mandatory reporting numbers that the hotels have to report to the Department of Building Inspection. The caveat here is that, you know, the law has since become stricter. So the numbers we have are prior to the inaction, I believe in March, of a law, and you have 60 hotels that did not report their data. So, you know, it stands to reason that hundreds more rooms are empty than the numbers we have in the story because people just blew off the requirements.
Joe Eskenazi is a reporter in San Francisco. He wrote the cover story for the latest edition of SF Public Press called No Vacancy for the Homeless. And if you can get your hands on the SF Public Press, it's an incredible newspaper with a number of specials this time around about people living on the streets. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Joe about why these owners of SROs would leave these rooms empty. We'll also talk about the relationship between these private hotels and the city of San Francisco. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington. On this Friday edition, you'll learn about China's leadership stabilized over the next 5 years, while Kenya's instability is explored. Among the stories on 1A, coming up at 11. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Joe Eskenazi. He's a reporter in San Francisco who wrote the cover story for the latest edition of SF Public Press. This is an independent media outlet. They put out a large newspaper, and they've got amazing graphics and just really good reporting. And Joe reports that dozens of residential hotels have rooms to spare in San Francisco, but the city cannot force owners to rent them. If you have any questions or comments for Joe about this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joe, you interviewed a few owners of SROs, people who wanted to remain anonymous. What did they tell you about why they're leaving so many rooms empty?
The fellows that I talked to do not leave the rooms empty, one of them did, but he claimed it was for refurbishments. However, you know, in many cases, and arguably even that one, those refurbishments, and you can have the air quotes around refurbishments, are keeping the rooms empty so as to refurbish them and then rent them out to people who are earning and willing to pay far more than the current residents. So in one sense, refurbishments can be accurate. You are trying to spruce up the room and attract, a better-paying clientele. One of the other reasons that you keep rooms empty is simply to drive up the value of the building. If you have, and this is the case with not just with SRO hotels, this is the case with apartment buildings as well, or for that matter, homes that have, you know, someone living in the basement or the attic, you know, in a additional unit. That lowers the cost of the building when you have a rent-controlled tenant or someone who has, a contract to live in the building. It's better for it to be empty. And so some of them are just driving up the value of the building.
When you ask them about possibly housing someone who doesn't have a home, what did people tell you?
A number of people. There are many SRO owners who, if not altruistic, are not wholly bottom-line oriented. There are some who do go out of their way to house homeless people or to house people of specific need, former foster children, things like that. They're not just villains in this business. There are some very bottom-line oriented people, though. And, you know, hey, I'm opening up a hotel. I'm making a business here. And if the city wants to bid higher than someone who's going to run a boutique hotel or some other entity, then they should bid higher. The way the city gets into the business, the analogy that repeatedly came up to me was peak oil, in which as it becomes more and more difficult to get a smaller and smaller bit of oil that's left in the earth, more onerous means and more expensive processes become feasible. The cost and the time that you take a year or two from now in order to extract oil, it's going to be acceptable to pay more and just, you know, a bigger production than 10 years ago, you know, et cetera. The same goes with acquiring rooms for the indigent by the city. They are willing to pay more than they did even a few years ago because, the other options they have also are more expensive. So that's the peak oil metaphor here. However, you're bidding against people that suddenly, you know, as the city becomes hotter and hotter, you're bidding against people who would want to house students there. You're bidding against people who would want to house, tech workers or other workers like that there. So suddenly, you know, you're competing against the private interests.
What is the financial and contractual agreements between these hotels and the city of San Francisco?
Master leasing agreements, usually the city will agree to cover the rooms and then bring in a nonprofit with experience to run the hotels. Nonprofits like Tenderloin Neighborhood Development Corporation or Tenderloin Housing Coalition, places like that. And you have people around the city, Don Falk, Gail Gilman, Randy Shaw, who have a hand in running many, many hotels and thousands of tenants.
Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I had an idea for having these rooms. There's thousands of vacant rooms all over San Francisco every night, you know, condos as well as SRO. And what could be done to fill those rooms is that the city could tax them at a much higher rate and thereby give a financial incentive for the owners to rent out those rooms. And with the tax money, the city could actually rent some of those rooms and put some of the homeless people in them.
Is anyone talking about that, Joe?
They're talking about that. The question is the second bullet in the bandolier of a vacancy tax or a forced, you know, if Aaron Peskin and others, Supervisor Aaron Peskin and others, and before him Jane Kim, before him Eric Moore, are talking about mandating putting your vacant units on the market. That may not be legal. A vacancy tax, not as stringent, but also may not be legal. So it's something that will have to pass muster with the city attorney, and it's something that will all but certainly be litigated. And even if you win, that's going to take a little time and effort.
There was a lot of reporting actually on this question back in July. A number of outlets in San Francisco have written about this. One of the Chronicle's headlines, "Should SF Tax Empty Homes and Buildings?" You can find that online. Thank you for the question. What else, when you were talking to people, Joe, what are some of the other solutions people would like to see? I mean, this is just a never-ending question in San Francisco. Well, not only in San Francisco, but up and down the state of California. We're just seeing the homeless population really exploding from Sacramento to Los Angeles, up north, you name it.
I think one of the most frustrating things for San Franciscans is that this ties into a lot of larger debates about housing in San Francisco. There's always endless debates about, how onerous should we make it upon people who are building quote-unquote market-rate housing? What percentage of affordable housing should they build? It is frustrating, for San Franciscans of all stripes to see housing built that is priced at a level that is out of the reach of most San Franciscans. And then the double punch in the gut is that people don't actually live in it. It's just an investment property, often for someone who doesn't live in this city, may not even live in this country. Mm-hmm. So these are difficult questions. For it to be happening on the lower end of the spectrum as well as the upper end of the spectrum is just indicative of the times we live in now. Things that you can do, there are a number of small solutions that are posited in an adjunct to this story that's also online, and it's also in the print edition there. One of the things that caught my eye, and that's why I put it first, is that when the city master leases hotels, the cost structure is such that we can't make it work out unless it's a big hotel. However, as you'd expect, the number of big hotels is very finite, and since San Francisco has been in the master leasing business for 20 years, the low-hanging fruit has been picked. If you limit the hotel stock that we could possibly jump in and master lease to hotels of 70 rooms or more, which is what the city can make ends meet with now, that's 90% of the private hotels, non-starters right off the bat. However, if you were able to have a more streamlined hotel, one that doesn't have a desk clerk 24 hours a day, for example, one that might not need all the social workers and other adjunct people that often are needed when you're administering to the homeless, you could get involved with smaller hotels. The caveat here is not having social workers, not having someone on site 24 hours means you're administering to some of the more functional homeless people that you've got. The city, for good reasons, is putting most of its money into helping the hardest up, the worst off. In doing so, it's neglecting less worse off homeless people who are still homeless and are still struggling. So that's a problem. That's a quandary.
Well, thank you for the call, David. We've got a similar question. Let's go to Nicholas in San Francisco. Hi, Nicholas.
Thank you. I heard there was a proposal before the Board of Supervisors to charge property owners for keeping units vacant. Actually, there are two units vacant in my building that have been vacant for more than 6 months. So who introduced that? Was it a formal bill introduced? And what is its status? Is there any hope of moving that forward?
That is the vacancy measure that we were discussing earlier. It has not been introduced yet. It has been essentially theorized, if for lack of a better term. This is something that may not be legal in the United States. The model that's often looked at is Vancouver, and of course, that's just a whole different ballgame up there. There may be constitutional restrictions with regard to what you can and cannot tell a private property owner to do with his or her property. So, certainly, we are a regulated country. We are a regulated city. Someone can't open up a McDonald's in their basement if they just want. They can't, there are rules. But as far as forcing someone to rent out their property, I don't, or charging them when they don't, I'm not sure how much more we can do than we're already doing. There already is a vacant fee, if not tax, for empty storefronts and empty and abandoned buildings. I don't know if you can make everyone put out all of their units. And then with the gentleman in question, our Department of Building Inspection workers are pretty well. I mean, they're working pretty hard. 6 months is a long time, but on the other hand, it's not outside the realm of possibilities that that's how long things would take to get a room up to speed, et cetera. And while in your case, there may be legitimate foot dragging, you know, checking on an apartment by apartment level would be difficult.
Thank you for calling in, Nicholas. One of your colleagues, Liz Enox, with the Public Press, has a piece called SF Soup's CEO Pay Tax to Fund Services. And she points out that lawmakers in Portland, Oregon, approved a surtax last year on companies with high CEO-to-worker pay ratios and dedicated the revenue to homeless services. I mean, the CEO-to-worker pay ratio is just massive compared to what it was in the 80s. And she reports that San Francisco could follow in Portland's footsteps if a measure floated by Supervisors Jane Kim and Hillary Ronan gained support. They have asked the city attorney's office to draft legislation based on an SEC rule requiring publicly traded companies to report how their CEO pay compares with that of workers. It'll be interesting to see how other supervisors respond to this, because we are seeing CEO pay just skyrocket, and we have a massive amount of billionaires and millionaires in the state of California.
I think it's a political winner. I don't think it's going to solve any problems. I don't think you're going to get much money that way, and I think that, you know, any intelligent CEO can structure his or her quote-unquote pay in a way that is not taxable. But it sounds like a political winner, and I can't see any problem with taxing CEOs and using the money for public good. There's no bad to that.
There was a quote in here also from Jenny Friedenbach with the Coalition on Homelessness. The fact that San Francisco spends $250 million a year on homelessness gets national attention. She said she examined the budget. I always hear about the budget, but I often don't hear people really examine it. And she examined it, and she said there's not a lot of waste in there. What have you heard?
I think that's a fair thing to say. I mean, I think that coverage of the homeless issues has gotten more sophisticated than what happened even a couple of years ago, of saying, hey, if you have X amount of homeless people and you have $250 million a year, you just do some simple division and it's this much dollars per homeless people, why don't we just give them a check? This is a very naive and simplistic way of thinking, because we're having a discussion about housing here. The whole point of housing is people stay housed. So a lot of that money is going to pay for people who are no longer homeless because we're paying for the housing. So that's expensive. And I think that that Ms. Friedenbach is correct. We're not wasting a lot of money. We can talk about the efficacy of what we're doing, but, you know, there's not a slush fund here. You know, there's not anything like you'd see in a comic book. There's no supervillain. There's no nobody is getting fabulously wealthy on this. There are the expression poverty pimps does come up, but these people aren't exactly living high off the hog. You know, I mean, there is some hardship given to some of the people who administer to the homeless because they live in nicer than average homes in the Berkeley Hills. But, you know, if you bought that house in 1978, that's just the nature of appreciation of property in California. So that's just the way it is. We're spending a lot of money because it's a big problem, and we're employing a lot of people. And one of the reasons so many nonprofits are involved is that when you get the city involved, suddenly you have our city employees earn more because of their pension costs and healthcare costs, et cetera. So all of these ancillary costs do add up. And what's more, housing's expensive. And without housing, you're not solving homelessness.
Well, let's take one more caller on this. Roberta in San Leandro. Hi, Roberta.
Show. Hi.
Hi.
So here's my thing. To the point, it's about, I really think this is about the inequality of income. Yet to resolve it, many cities, such as, let's say, Salt Lake City as an example, 10 or so years ago, the mayor wanted to solve initially removing all the homeless veterans off of the streets. And then from that program expanded out to all of their homeless population, whereby, to your point, they get counseling and assistance. They have an address where their Social Security or, you know, disability checks can go to. They become, again, within a 2-year period, you know, good, I don't know, a citizen who can work and take care of themselves again. We as America really need to look at our compassion and figure out how to fix this, because any of us, it could happen to any of us in a minute.
Thank you, Roberta.
This is true. So the compassion, you can't buy compassion, but $250 million can buy you an awful lot. And so the city definitely has prioritized this and is putting money towards it. I think, you know, we are actually making good steps in that it's becoming more organized and, you know, knock on wood, it's becoming easier to navigate. If any of the listeners have ever, you know, gone to the emergency room, et cetera, you get 27 different envelopes. They ask you for no money. They ask you for no money. Suddenly they're asking for thousands of dollars, et cetera. It's something that even someone who's, you know, a master's PhD student is bewildered. If you're a homeless person on the street, not to patronize people, but, you know, you might not have the easiest time following all the rules. That might be one of the, you know, you might have had hardships in life. It, you know, asking people to show up to meetings and then being very hard on them when they don't, and cutting them off and making it very difficult to get general assistance, and, you know, making hoops for people to jump through who have had trouble already or they wouldn't be in this situation, right, is not productive. And so we have to improve that. And that's why we may not be wasting all that much money. We can improve that and have better outcomes that way.
Well, and just as you said, dealing with the day-to-day is difficult enough. Lugging your stuff around, figuring out where you're going to sleep tonight. Oh, your meals across town. I mean, it's so difficult. Not only that, it's so hot right now.
Absolutely.
I ran into a man right outside of Rainbow the other day who was on the verge of fainting because it is so hot. So one thing you might want to do, I mean, it's a tiny thing, but carry some cold water bottles around and pass them out. I mean, where do people go to get water?
So
something very basic.
That's compassion. I mean, anyone who's ever wandered around downtown, there's nowhere to go to the bathroom. You know, and if you are a homeless person, you know, business owners might not be thrilled to let you in to use the bathroom. These things are real.
Yeah. Well, now we're going to talk about something that is very related at the national level. We're going to talk about the budget and tax cuts to get a quick update from Arthur Delaney. He's a reporter with the Huffington Post who covers politics and the economy. Hi, Arthur. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. We were just talking about the homeless crisis here in San Francisco, and we wanted to bring you on to get a quick update about what's happening in D.C. with the budget. Can you give us a quick blueprint of this budget? 20 Republicans and all Democrats in the House voted against it. All California, 14 actually, House Republicans voted for it.
It was a budget, but don't think of it as a budget, because really this was a procedural vote on tax reform. The budget document is essentially irrelevant and will have no effect on policy. But once both chambers of Congress have passed the budget, and that's what happened this week, they will be able to get tax reform legislation through the Senate with only 51 votes instead of the 60 that is required to overcome opposition from Democrats. So it was a key procedural step and progress towards Republicans doing their tax reform agenda.
So this tax bill will not need support from a single Democrat. Can you explain how this works?
Well, it's just for parliamentary reasons that when you pass a budget, you can unlock this budget reconciliation process. That's what it's called, reconciliation. And it lowers the vote total that is needed to get something through the Senate. And that's important because their plan is to do tax reform with only Republican votes, because it's going to be massive tax cuts, especially for wealthier individuals, and that's something that Democrats are not going to get on board with.
You know, I keep hearing, obviously, the media are giving this a lot of attention, calling it tax reform. David K. Johnston, who is a former tax reporter with the New York Times, says it's not reform. It's actually cuts for the wealthy and corporations. An analysis by the Tax Policy Center, a nonpartisan group, found that the wealthiest 1% of Americans, 1%, would reap 79% of the benefits of the plan over 10 years.
That's right. The difference between tax cuts and reforms, really this becomes a semantic game, but the reason they're calling it reform is because they do want to simplify the tax code, and one way they're doing that would be by reducing the number of tax brackets in the on the individual income tax side from 7 to 3. So that would be simpler. And another important way that they would simplify the tax code is by eliminating most deductions and exemptions that rich people, but also a lot of middle-class people, use. And that really would simplify things for a lot of people and the IRS. But it's anyone's guess whether they'll actually succeed in the end, though they are making progress this week.
A lot of the details still have to come out, but based on what you have read from independent analysts, Arthur, how will this tax plan affect, well, what is the middle? I mean, what's in the middle in San Francisco is so different from what's in the middle in rural Texas or even up north in California, right? But let's just say people who are struggling to make ends meet or people who just make enough to pay their bills, how will it affect them?
Well, a funny thing about getting rid of all these deductions and exemptions that you might think benefit people with accountants, they actually also benefit basically everybody who files a tax return. So there's a serious question whether middle-class people, particularly upper-middle-class people, would benefit at all from this plan, because losing these deductions could result in tax increases, especially for families with children who benefit from a personal exemption that lowers your taxable income by $4,000 for each person in your household. So Republicans at this point aren't even promising that every middle-class household will benefit. It's clear that their top priority here is to reduce the tax burden on businesses and higher income people, and it costs, we lose so much revenue if you do that, that they're, part of their simplification actually adds revenue back in by getting rid of the deductions that middle class people use. So they raise money from households that way.
And just quickly, Arthur, what can we expect from the Koch brothers in the coming weeks? According to reports, they're going to launch major campaigns to get people to support this. The Washington Post's Paul Waldman has a piece called "Here's the Real Reason Republicans Must Pass Tax Cuts for the Rich." He says the billionaire Koch brothers are not bankrolling a multi-million dollar effort to promote tax cuts because they're hoping the cuts will benefit the average Joe.
There's going to be an absolute frenzy. Like, it hasn't started yet in earnest, because they all they have is this like couple pages with a framework outlining sort of the direction they want to go. There's no legislation yet, but it's going to come out next week, and sure, the Koch brothers will have TV ads, and other groups will as well, but there will also be fierce lobbying from various interest groups that benefit massively from tax breaks. Like, the mortgage interest deduction is effectively gutted in this plan, even though they ostensibly keep it. And realtors are going to be super mad. They already are pretty mad, but they're sort of keeping their powder dry since the bill itself hasn't been officially released. It's going to start next week.
Arthur Delaney is a reporter with the Huffington Post covering politics and the economy. Arthur, we'll definitely have you back in the coming weeks to give us the latest. Thank you for joining us.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me, Rose.
Thank you. Joe Eskenazi wrote the cover story for the latest edition of SF Public Press called "No Vacancy for the Homeless." He reports that dozens of residential hotels have rooms to spare, but the city of San Francisco cannot force owners to rent them. Joe, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much. SFPublicPress.org.
Yes, and you all do amazing work. Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us. It's Your Call.